on RN. Time for the Philosopher's Zone. Joe Gelonesi with you. Great to have your company. Today, we return to the theme of animals.
Schopenhauer, in fact, did have an animal ethics. He said that suffering was the basis of an animal ethics where we can empathize with other creatures who suffer. So really, it's through our emotive suffering that we are able to empathize and bond with other creatures who experience emotional lives like we do.
Animal lives wax and wane in the history of Western thought. Pythagoras was the first animal-friendly philosopher, but the pickings get slim after that. Now, two present-day philosophers want to make amends, with a project drawing together science, ecology, history, and philosophy. They aim to illuminate the nature of animal experience to make better sense of our relationships with them. Leon Nemachinsky and Stephanie Theodoro are at Immaculata University in the United States.
Given the scientific research that's available and the neurology involved, there's a large amount of data that suggests that the emotional pain that you and I experience is qualitatively no different than, say, for example, the emotional pain an elephant or a chimpanzee may experience.
Mm. Animal grief has been seen in wild, in animals. That's one of the areas you look at?
Absolutely. Elephants in particular have elaborate rituals and behavior which suggests that there's an internal experience of grief going on. For example, there's elephant graveyards. They'll caress and touch the bones of the dead and members in their family who have died. There's been cases of wolves even who've lost family members in the pack and grieve the loss of those in the pack. So there's many, many anecdotes that suggest animals are entirely capable of feeling the pain of losing a loved one. And we believe that this has important ethical consequences because, again, as I said, the pain that you and I would experience emotionally is similar to what other species of animals experience.
Mm. But how do we know that they are grieving? How can we come to that conclusion?
We've drawn upon the research of Mark Bekoff, who essentially argues that science reveals that there is indeed a core of primal emotions hardwired into the evolutionary limbic system, particularly the amygdala, which is the oldest emotional part of the brain. Human beings as well have this part of the brain, as do, however, fish, amphibians, reptiles, and birds. What it is a neural substrate responsible for any core primary emotion. So what it boils down to is that we share the same neural mechanisms that produce these emotions. And what Bekoff and others are suggesting is that even in some cases without a neocortex, which is the outer layer of the brain, the newer part of the brain, which is responsible for higher order thinking or even more developed emotions, is not needed for animals to experience emotions.
Yeah, particularly with his experiment with rats, mm-hmm. baby rats, where he removed, it's called decorticizing, he removed the external layer of cortex from baby rats and found that they still engaged in play behavior and, in fact, increased their play behavior after alternately being isolated and then paired up again together. So this indicates that it may not be necessary for the prefrontal cortex or temporal cortex or parietal cortex to have to be there.
What is the history of Western philosophy when it comes to the question of animals and emotions?
By and large, it's been terrible, other than Pythagoras until this century.
Yes. Well, you know, I felt a glimmer of hope when I was reading over some of Plato in his dialogue, the Timaeus, where he refers to the entire universe as a kind of perfect world animal, a kind of cosmic animal, and where all parts are working together and interfacing in a way which is perfect. And as he moves on to the actual physical universe with real creatures, humans and animals, we are to be understood, and animals, as microcosms of that perfect macrocosm. And so there is order, structure, a kind of essence, if you will, in all of creation. Even before Plato, Pythagoras, very interested in supporting the idea that animals have a kind of soul. What we see with Pythagoras is that animals really do live in accordance with a kind of divine principle in the universe. So they are to be respected. Now, once we get into the medieval thinkers, Aquinas, for example, Aquinas, for various theological reasons, argues that animals lack intrinsic value, and he argues that we are actually superior to animals and all other vegetative life. And this really reflects the classical medieval hierarchy of being, where all creatures are ranked according to their ability to consciously reflect and know truth, that is, understand God as the absolute truth. And so the further down one goes, the less mind one has. The argument is the less one is able to understand God, and so animals fall below us. And then we have some interesting developments as we move. Well, we have Descartes in the early modern period, who is really famous for kind of being quite negative about all of this, stating that basically animals are machines that are responding to stimuli. So that's a purely functional, we would call, explanation. And Descartes' thinking is still reflected in the thinking of hardline materialist thinkers like Dennett, for example.
There are many more. Obviously, Descartes and Aquinas, yes, they're two I do want to pick on, because they frame what is probably still the mainstream way that animals have been viewed to some degree.
Yes. If we return to that great chain of being, anything which displays more matter in its being, such as a rock or a plant, and then moving up the ladder to creatures, anything that has more physicality is seen as further away from the divine essence of all things, God. And God is portrayed as a completely immaterial spirit, completely divorced from matter. So there you have the beginnings of the matter and form and matter and essence division, which even Descartes will uphold quite strictly, saying that mind and body then are absolutely distinct entities, can only be joined at what he thought was this little gland, the pineal gland. He thought that was the place where they interacted, and how the mind sort of interacted, directed the body to do different things. So now Descartes takes the theological aspect out of the medieval period and sort of discards that, just calls it an immaterial soul. There is a God there, but the soul is completely distinct from the body. And he upholds this distinction on the basis that the soul is really what's capable of reflecting on sensation. So the body provides sensation, but the body can't understand what's happening.
Right. And Joe, that's also the danger I wanted to point out too, is that with the medieval and modern periods, philosophers like Aquinas and Descartes, animals were seen to be lesser than human being, in fact, put there, say, for example, by God for our use or for our domination, and they weren't thought to be able to self-reflect. But going back to your question earlier about animal grief, I mean, clearly these animals are aware of the emotional experiences that they're undergoing. We had talked about elephants and elephant graveyards, or wolves kind of lamenting the loss of others in the pack. I mean, clearly these animals are behaving as if they are subjects of a life who are perfectly capable of experiencing the same emotions that you and I do, but this was denied to them by Aquinas and Descartes. So by and large, for the history of philosophy until this century, where these days now we focus more on the physical pain. Peter Singer, for example, in his animal ethics, bases animal rights on whether animals can feel pleasure or pain, and you know, we have a duty that they not feel pain unnecessarily. But I would like to include emotional pain along with physical pain as a criteria by which we can judge the welfare of animals.
Mm. Tell me about Alfred North Whitehead and why he's important to this discussion.
Sure. Alfred North Whitehead is a process relational philosopher. He's included in the American philosophical tradition, actually from England first and then moved over to Harvard. What Whitehead suggests is that reality is experiential, and he's in a camp of philosophers known as panpsychists, meaning that awareness or a primitive form of consciousness is present pretty much everywhere. Most acutely, he's interested in animal consciousness. And he follows the Darwinian line of thinking, which states that the differences between humans and non-human animals is not of kind, but of degree. And so again, the feeling, the sensation, the emotion that you and I have is also had by other forms of life. Whitehead is incredibly, incredibly important, I think, for even building in the future new forms of animal ethics that recognize that animals have feelings and that really the qualitative nature of experience is in fact emotive, and we ought to pay attention to that.
Hmm. This continuity of feeling, this is at the base of this idea, isn't it? That there is something that continues all the way through the chain of life or lives.
Yes. As I was listening to Leon there, I'm reminded of a philosopher who provides a kind of very interesting link between the will to life that animals all display, this will to power, if you will. Not so much Nietzsche, but talking about Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer really saw animals as valid expressions of what he called nature's will. Nature wills to be, and animals are part of that, and so they are to be respected as such. It's interesting because he drew quite a bit of that from Asian philosophy, from Hinduism. So Schopenhauer is a Western thinker who tries to unite through this notion of the will. Mm-hmm. Nature is willing itself through the existence of animals and in the emotions that animals display.
What I like about Schopenhauer, too, is that the will can be interpreted as a sense of agency, that,
yes,
speaking in terms of panpsychism, for example, that living forms have an agency and that agency ought to be respected. And we often think in terms of human agency but neglect non-human agency. We tend to think that we have all the control or we make the decisions. However, there are other forms of life with their own goals in mind and their own subjective experiences. And scientifically today, we tend to ignore the qualitative dimension of those experiences. Schopenhauer, in fact, did have an animal ethics. He said that suffering was the basis, qualitatively speaking, suffering. It should be the basis of an animal ethics where we can empathize with other creatures who suffer.
Yes.
And interestingly, too, Whitehead said that God is the fellow sufferer who understands. So really, it's through our emotive suffering that we are able to empathize and bond with other creatures who experience emotional lives like we do.
And that brings us back to the idea that emotion is running through all of this, mm-hmm, linking all creatures,
yep,
to one another.
You like a massage?
A lot of times people say to me, well, how do you know dogs can't, you know, how do you know what dogs feel? Or wolves, animals I study, they don't talk to us. I mean, one retort, of course, is how do you know they don't? And since my argument is that we should err on the side of the animals, because what we believe about what animals feel informs how we treat them.
Mark Bekoff, his work with animals laying the platform for Leon Nemachinsky's and Stephanie Theodoro's project. You're with a pet-friendly Philosopher's Zone today here on RN. So back to this question then of emotion, which, as you just said, is absolutely crucial to this link and in the end to the ethical link between animals and humans. How can we be sure? I'm coming back to this question partly because you sent me scurrying to that great essay by Thomas Nagel on what is it like to be a bat, and I reread that in preparation to talk to you. And I guess it's hard to dodge the key point in there, which is we can't really know that single point of view that another,
right,
being has.
Yes. On the one hand, it makes it problematic because we tend to anthropomorphize and project our own feeling qualities onto the animals we're studying. We have to beware of that. On the other hand, Nagel's argument gives credence to the idea that there really is some kind of somewhat meaningful inner life, even in a bat. And that inner life is based on how its perceptual nervous system is organized. And it's organized quite differently than ours. It's based on sonar and echolalation. And so we'll never know how a bat processes this form of experience from their own perspective. But that still supports the idea that there's a kind of experience that's had there in that moment. The bat is experiencing something. It's real.
We encounter the same problem with human beings, and known as the problem of other minds. So it's like saying, well, because I can't access your emotions directly, that your emotional experience isn't real. And this is why phenomenology, I think, is important for both Stephanie and her work and mine, is that really we have an obligation to speculatively imagine experiences of non-human consciousness, okay? And that it's looking to animal behavior in terms of ethology, but philosophically opening the questions. I think to Nagel's credit, he does at one point say that a quote-unquote objective phenomenology is possible.
At the end of his essay.
And what this means is we can rely on a semiotic or symbolic expressive communication. We can look to how animals behave and trust that the way they're behaving indicates, just like you or I would look to each other to look at each other's facial expressions or vocalizations, et cetera, to say, okay, what is going on in there? It's not an absolutely closed mystery, although it is a mystery. Physiologically, we have analogs to derive that, okay, these experiences are similar in how they feel. So I don't think we should be discouraged that because that point of view is cut off, that we can't know that there is a qualitative experience going on. So in that sense, I feel both speculative philosophy and phenomenology are both very important. And I think Nagel hinted to that in his essay.
Mm. One of the key ways of understanding this, too, is thoughts themselves do not have to have linguistic properties. What we're looking for, perhaps sometimes, is something which is an analogy of us. That is, that we have thoughts which linguistically propelled, but we don't necessarily have to look for these things in the state of nature.
That's true. In fact, the language of animals, they do have languages, they just do not use words like you or I use. For example, dolphins are able to communicate mostly through sound. The part of their brain that interprets sound is, I believe it's about 10 times larger than that same part of the brain in the human being. Some of our research that we've covered in our book talks about how each and every single dolphin has a unique name. They're able to communicate through clicks and noises and so on. And the same with elephants. Elephants are able to use infrasound below the range of human hearing. It's around 16 hertz, where they can emit a low grumble, which can travel really for about 12 to 15 miles and move itself around bushes and so on. So there's a lot of evidence that semiotic expression need not necessarily be in terms of human concepts per se or human language per se. I think Stephanie also can add to this and some of the research that she's encountered.
Oh, yes. Well, we have in our work a study done where there's evidence for facial recognition in sheep. Sheep do display preferences for certain kinds of faces. It's been shown that they're able to discriminate between one another, between sheep and human faces, between different breeds even within themselves. And there's another study, Dittrich in 1990, studied macaques and found that they were able to recognize through facial outline, and they were especially drawn to contours of the eyes and mouth and those systems that suggest emotions. So there's a response to the eye, to the mouth, especially to mouths with teeth or shapes of eyes, and respond to changes in facial expression. And so certainly there you have nonverbal emotional cues.
It seems the science is laying out a lot of evidence, which you're now taking at a conceptual level to try and put this argument together. Can I ask, why is it important in an ethical sense that we come to grips with this idea that animals do have a form of emotional life?
Well, that's just it. They have a form of emotional life. Clearly, they are subjects of a life. They're aware of a to whom this is happening. Even as early as, say, 50 years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room. No one would have taken you seriously had you said animals are capable of experiencing emotions and are aware of it. So in that respect, the scientific element is crucial. But ethically, what this means is that they're subjects of a life. There's so much similarity in terms of the kinds of emotions that these animals are experiencing. And again, if, you know, the emotional trauma, stress, and anxiety that an animal feels is qualitatively no different than you or I feel, and if I'm going to give you as a human being a certain amount of respect and, say, protection, then that animal ought to deserve the same amount of respect and protection. There's been studies done in neuropsychiatric disorders with dairy calves who have been separated from their mothers. And even after a day of separation, there's incredible trauma. And they've analyzed this trauma empirically by analyzing the vocalizations of these dairy calves. Infant elephants wail uncontrollably by their dead mothers. I mean, horrible states of grief and distress that, again, qualitatively are no different. And so they deserve the same respect, the same protection that you or I would, the same treatment that you or I would.
fascinating. Just to a point made earlier, which is the power of medieval thought, certainly Aquinas, and then to Descartes, to frame this debate so late into, I guess, post-Enlightenment period. Why would that be the case? Is the role of science, which is now uncovering or helping us understand this issue so much better, do you think that science itself may have at some point also helped that argument, or at least amplified Descartes and Aquinas' understanding of animals into our modern world?
But yes, the scientific revolution really changed everything and gave us this mechanistic view of the universe. And people like Descartes and Hobbes, and more so even Hobbes, and now Daniel Dennett, he's our modern materialist functionalist, they all argue that all of life can be understood as, to put it in Hobbes' way, matter in motion, as adaptive, evolutionary, biological, neurochemical, electrical organization, self-organization, and that we can observe these processes, we can measure these processes, and in doing so, we've pretty much explained the nature of life and certainly the nature of what we call consciousness, which Dennett argues today, the modern Cartesian, argues is a trick that the mind plays on itself, a trick that the brain is playing on itself. He calls this the Cartesian theater. By the way, he takes Descartes down as well. He's not a dualist, certainly, right, the way Descartes was, because he's gotten rid of the idea of a essence or some kind of animating spirit or soul.
But Joe, on the other hand, too, the opposite of this would be the Eastern philosophers, the Buddhists, the Jains, the Hindus, but also the American pragmatists, those in the working the tradition of phenomenology and process relational philosophy. All of those traditions recognize the qualitative experiential dimension of animal experience, the emotive dimension, that there seems to be some irreducible, non-quantifiable experiential stream present within living forms that science cannot lock and stock, put a number on.
But that's what's flying in the face of what the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment were trying to establish,
right,
with such certainty. And then we're finding that, you know, there might be something missing there.
Right. And on the upside, however, there are current philosophers such as Bruno Latour or Isabel Stengers, who are anthropologists, who are scientifically minded philosophers as well, who recognize the experiential component I just mentioned. And their work tries to think more ecologically or holistically in terms of representing all forms of experience, what they call a multi-naturalism, if you will, to look at the many and varied perspectives of agents or actors at play in these networks.
You know, thinking about working from what Leon just said, how does one then possibly respond to Dennett, even granting him his own premise? That is, well, let's say it is the case that nature has this way of organizing neurobiological systems that create these illusions of felt qualities or the experience of consciousness. Well, let's say these are illusions. They're still felt.
Practically, it makes no difference.
You know, the organism is experiencing something. Now, what Dennett has a problem with, and people like him, is saying, well, there's some kind of irreducible subjectivity, some mysterious entity we call consciousness that's having the experience. But even if that's not there, if we grant him his premise, the animal is still suffering, or we are still suffering, even if we're under the illusion that our minds have created for us. We're still suffering. It's real. And it calls for a response.
Stephanie Theodoro and Leon Nemechinsky on the emotional lives of animals. And both Stephanie and Leon are at Immaculata University in the United States. We'll put a link to their open access book on our website. The Philosopher's Zone this week has been brought to you by Diane Dean, Charles McCune, and me, Joe Gelonesi. Join us next week for the final in our first season for the year. It's especially for you if you're a film buff. See you then.